failing infrastructure, for example, are to be preferred to any inroad on his or her monetary fiefdom, large or small. This is as touchy a point as our limits on so-called Second Amendment rights. Both sensitivities, which are treated as if they were protections against centralization and collectivism, are having profound consequences for society as a whole, and this without meaningful public debate, without referendum. Citizenship, which once implied obligation, is now deflated, that is, given an artificial value by use that treats it as primarily a limited good that ought to be limited further. The degree to which citizen and taxpayer ever existed, exists now, or can be set apart as distinct types, is a question complicated by the fact that they are imposed on public consciousness by politicians playing to constituencies, by interest groups, by journalism that repeats unreflectingly whatever gimmicky notion is in the air and reinforces it. It can be said, however, that whenever the taxpayer is invoked as the protagonist in the public drama, stalwart defender of his own, past and potential martyr to a culture of dependency and governmental overreach, we need not look for generosity, imagination, wit, poetry, or eloquence. We certainly need not look for the humanism Tocqueville saw as the moving force behind democracy. I will put aside a fact that should be too obvious to need stating, that America has done well economically, despite passing through difficult periods from time to time, as countries do. It would be very hard indeed to make the case that the Land-Grant College Act has done us any harm, or that the centrality of the liberal arts in our education in general has impeded the development of wealth. True, a meteor strike or some equivalent could put an end to this tomorrow, but if we were obliged to rebuild ourselves, we could not find a better model for the creation of wealth than our own history. I do not mean to suggest that wealth is to be thought of as our defining achievement, or that it is the first thing we should protect or recover. But since money is the measure of all things these days, it is worth pointing out that there are no grounds for regarding our educational culture as in need of rationalization. It must be clear that I take exception to this use of the word, to align it with current economic doctrine. All this sidesteps the old Kantian distinction, whether people are to be dealt with as means or as ends. The argument against our way of educating is that it does not produce workers who are equipped to compete in the globalized economy, the economy of the future. This has to be as blunt a statement as could be made about the urgency, currently felt in some regions and credulously received and echoed everywhere, that we should put our young to this use, to promote competitive adequacy at a national level, to whose profit or benefit we are never told. There is no suggestion that the gifts they might bring to the world as individuals, stimulated by broad access to knowledge, have place or value in this future world, only that we should provide, in place of education, what would better be called training. If all institutions feel this pressure in some degree, public institutions feel it most continuously and profoundly. A university like mine, founded almost 170 years ago, before Iowa would even have had much in the way of cornfields, gives unambiguous evidence of the kinds of hopes that lay behind its founding and sustained it through many generations. From an early point, it emphasized the arts. It was founded while Emerson was active and at about the time Tocqueville was published, and can fairly be assumed to have shared their worldview. So with many or most public universities in America. Accepting creative work toward a graduate degree, the MFA, as we know it now, was an innovation of the University of Iowa. My own program, the Writer's Workshop, is the oldest thing of its kind on the planet. People do ask me from time to time why Iowa is in Iowa, for the same reason Bloomington is in Indiana, no doubt. If we were better pragmatists, we would look at the fact that people given a relatively blank slate, the prairie, and a pool of public resources, however modest, are at least as desirous of the wonderful as of the profitable or necessary. Atavism is a potent force in human history. There is the pull of the retrograde, an almost physical recoil, much more potent than mere backsliding, much more consequential than partial progress or flawed reform. The collective mind can find itself re-inhabited by old ideas almost unconsciously almost unwillingly. A word around which retrograde thinking is often constellated is elitist. Liberal education was for a very long time reserved to an elite, whence the word liberal befitting free men who were a small minority in Western societies. Gradually, except by the standards of the world at large, Americans began democratizing privilege. As Tocqueville remarks, heaven shares out by chance those high gifts of intellect and culture which had previously been associated arbitrarily with status and advantage, and were now manifest as a vastly more generous endowment. We need only allow the spread of learning to see the brilliance potential in humankind. But the memory persists that the arts were once social attainments, and that the humanities suited one to a position of authority. What use could they be to ordinary people? What claim should anything of such doubtful utility have on the public purse? Or, to look at the matter from another side, why should an English class at the University of Wisconsin be as excellent as an English class at Stanford University for a mere fraction of the cost? The talk we hear so often now about top-tier universities, about supposed rankings, creates an economics of scarcity in the midst of an astonishing abundance, and it helps to justify assaults on great public resources of the kind we have seen recently in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Public universities are stigmatized as elitist because they continue in the work of democratizing privilege, of opening the best thought and the highest art to anyone who wishes to have access to them. They are attacked as elitist because their tuition goes up as the supports they receive from government go down. The citizen had a country, a community, children and grandchildren, even, a word we no longer hear, posterity. The taxpayer has a 401k. It is no mystery that one could be glad to endow monumental libraries, excellent laboratories, concert halls, arboretums, baseball fields, and the other simply can't see the profit in it for himself. There is pressure to transform the public university so that less cost goes into it and more benefit comes out, as such things are reckoned in terms of contemporary economic thinking. That this economics could be so overbearingly sure of itself ought to be remarkable given recent history, but its voice is magnified in the void left by the default of other traditional centers of authority. In any case, whether and how we educate people is still a direct reflection of the degree of freedom we expect them to have or want them to have. Since printing became well established in the West and the great usefulness of literacy began to be recognized, it has been as characteristic of cultures to withhold learning as to promote it. They have done both, selectively, and the effect of this kind of discrimination has been profound, persisting in the present, as it will certainly persist into the future. In most Western cultures, the emergence of literacy in women lagged far behind literacy in men, and in many parts of the world it is still forbidden or discouraged, despite or perhaps because of the fact that this disability in women radically slows economic development, among other things. Western progress is arguably an uncertain road to happiness, I know, but insofar as Western civilization has made a value of freeing the mind by giving it ability and resources, it has been a wondrous phenomenon. Wherever its strong, skilled attention has fallen on the world, it has made some very interesting errors, without doubt, and it has also revealed true splendors. In either case, it has given us good reason to ponder the mind itself, the character of the human mind being so richly inscribed on the cultural experience of all of us, in the ways and degrees that we, as individual minds, are prepared to read its inscriptions. Insofar as American civilization assumes literacy, it saturates our lives with print. It also fails to make an important minority of its people competent in this skill most of us could not imagine living without. Old exclusions come down the generations. We all know that parents are the first teachers. Old injustices come down the generations. Why bother to educate people who have no use for education, the hewers of wood and drawers of water? The argument was made that peasants, women, slaves, industrial workers would be happier knowing nothing about a world that would be closed to them in any case. Therefore, For a very long time it was closed to them, since they could be assumed to be ignorant of it. In the degree that all this has changed, social equality and mobility have followed. Many traditional barriers are lower, if they have not yet fallen. What exactly is the impetus behind the progressive change that has been simultaneous with the emergence of modern society? Our era could well be said to have had its origins in a dark age. The emergence of the factory system and mass production brought a degree of exploitation of human beings for which even feudalism had no equivalent. The severest possible cheapening of labor in early industry was supported by the same theories that drove colonialism and chattel slavery. The system yielded spectacular wealth, of course, islands of wealth based on extreme poverty and on the profounder impoverishments of slavery. Comparisons are made between slavery and so-called free labor, which seem always to imply that the second was more efficient than the first, therefore destined on economic grounds to become the dominant system and to bring with it a general amelioration of conditions. It is a very imprecise use of language to describe as free a labor force largely composed of children who, on the testimony of Benjamin Disraeli, among many others, could not and did not expect to live far beyond childhood. It is an imprecise use of language to call free the great class of laborers who had no rights even to shelter outside the parishes where they were born. The fact of social progress has been treated as demonstrating that laissez-faire works for us all, that the markets are not only wise, but also benign, indeed humane. This argument is based on history that is effectively invented to serve it, and on a quasi-theology of economic determinism, a monotheism in that it cannot entertain the possibility or the suggestion that social circumstance can have any other origin than economics. Clever as we think we are enacting again the strange and epical tendency of Western civilization to impoverish. We have come to a place where these assumptions are being tested, in reality at least, if not in our universities and think tanks. Reality is that turbulent region our thoughts visit seldom and briefly, like Baedeker tourists eager to glimpse the sights that will confirm our expectations and put us on shared conversational ground with decades of fellow tourists. We leave trash on Mount Everest, we drop trash in the sea, and reality goes on with its life, reacting to our depredations as it must while ages pass, continents clash, and infernos boil over. It is true that our carelessness affects the world adversely, and it is also true that the world can fetch autochthonous surprises up out of its fiery belly. The metaphor is meant to suggest that we are poor observers, rarely seeing more than we intend to see. Our expectations are received, therefore static, which makes it certain that they will be like nothing in reality. Still, we bring our expectations with us, and we take them home with us again, reinforced. Historical time also has a fiery belly and a capacity for devastating eruptions. It has equivalents for drought and desert, for glaciation. Its atmosphere can dim and sicken. Any reader of history knows this. If the changes that occur in it are very substantially the result of human activity, they seem rarely to reflect human intention, at least when they are viewed in retrospect. They seem always to elude human notice until they are irreversible, overwhelming. Western civilization had had a significant place among world cultures in articulating the sense of vastnesses and richnesses in its painting, poetry, music, architecture, and philosophy. Then, rather suddenly, this great ancient project was discountenanced altogether. The sacred has since been declared to have been a meaningless category, a name for something in fact compounded of fear, hope, and ignorance, and configured around certain ancient tales and ceremonies, a forgivable error in an earlier age. That it yielded works of extraordinary beauty and profundity was acknowledged fulsomely in modernist nostalgia, whose exponents saw themselves as the victims of the transformations they announced, and in a considerable degree created. Grand-scale change was in fact imminent and inevitable, of course. Empires were falling, technology was rising. Whether the New Age need have brought with it this mawkish gloom is another question. I propose that the thought we call modern was by no means robust and coherent enough intellectually to discredit metaphysics and theology, among many other things, though it did discredit them. To account for this, I would suggest that its appeal to the upper strata of culture was in the fact that it closed questions rather than opening them. Its nostalgias made it resistant to reform and excused it from giving a rational defense of its resistance. It created the narrative of a breach with the European past by ignoring European history. Granting the horrors of the First World War, Europe seems to have comforted itself by arming for the Second World War. That is to say, humankind has always given itself occasions for grief and despair, and has seldom made better use of them than to store up grudges and provocations to prepare the next occasion. Human cultural achievements may be thought of as somewhat apart from these periodic rampages. There are no grounds for thinking of high civilizations as less violent than any others. No grounds, that is, except in the histories and anthropologies that are written by them. So long as warfare and other enormities are treated as paradoxical, anomalous, aberrant, we lack a sufficiently complex conception of humankind. History can tell us that neither side of our nature precludes the other. The worst we do does not diminish the goodness of the best we do. That our best is so often artistic more than utilitarian, in the usual senses of both words, is a fact with which we should learn to be at peace. The arts have been under attack since Plato, at least, on the grounds that they had no useful role in society. They are under attack at present. We have persuaded ourselves that the role of the middle ranks of our population is to be of use to the economy. More precisely, to the future economy, of which we know nothing for certain, but which we can fairly imagine to be as unlike the present one as it is unlike the order that prevailed a few decades ago. If the present is any guide, we can anticipate further profound disruption. So such coherence as the economy has created in the culture to this point cannot at all be assumed. The reverence paid to economic forces, which, with the accelerating accumulation of wealth in very few hands, increasingly amounts to little more than faceless people with no certain qualifications playing with money, enforces the belief that our hopes must be surrendered to these forces. The coherence society might take from politics, that is, from consciousness that it is a polity, a human community with a history and with a habit of aspiration toward democracy requiring a capacity in its public for meaningful decisions about its life and direction, exists apart from these forces and is at odds with them. So far as they are determinist and so long as they succeed in defining utility, that is, value and legitimacy, for the rest of us, we have surrendered even the thought of creating a society that can sustain engagement and purpose beyond that endless openness and submissiveness to other people's calculations and objectives that we call competitiveness. At the moment, two things are taken to be true. One, that our society must be disciplined and trained to compete in a global market, and two, that these competitive skills have no definable character. Who might not be displaced by a computer or a robot? Who might not be displaced by an offshore worker, an adjunct? Economics, from its brutal beginnings, has told us that cheapened labor will give its employers a competitive advantage, and that costlier labor will drive industries into extinction or into foreign labor markets. Oddly, even monstrously costly executives seem never to have this effect. Economics has told us that labor both creates value and is the greatest cost in the production of value. When Marx wrote about these things, he was using a long-established vocabulary, still descriptive now, therefore useful. There is nationalism involved in all this, historically. The colonial system, which was entirely bound up in trade and industry, enjoyed the power and the sense of grandeur of the old European empires. The global reach of the early industrial system made mass poverty a national asset, as it is now. According to the theory that rationalized it, the worker's wage could not exceed the level necessary to his subsistence, that is, the level necessary to leave him, more probably her, physically able to work. I believe this brazen law, as they called it, is still in force in many of those societies with which we are told we are competing. The most obvious evidence that the United States proceeded for a long time on other assumptions is our educational system, which is by now seen by very many people as an obstacle to our recruiting ourselves to the great project of competing in the world economy. If it is no longer clear what these singular institutions should be doing, it is pretty clear what they should not be doing, which is disseminating knowledge and culture, opening minds. The dominant view now is that their legitimate function is not to prepare people for citizenship in a democracy, but to prepare them to be members of a docile, though skilled, working class. It has been characteristic of American education that it has offered students a great variety of fields of study and a great freedom to choose among them. It has served as a mighty paradigm for the kind of self-discovery Americans have historically valued. Now this idea has gone into eclipse. The freedom of the individual seems to have been reduced to a right to belligerent ignorance coupled with devotion to a particular reading of the Second Amendment. Other than this, they are offered a future in which their particular interests, gifts, and values will have very minimal likelihood of expression, since they are very likely not to suit the uses of whatever employment is on offer. They must give up the thought of shaping their own lives, of having even the moral or political right to try to stabilize them against the rigors and uncertainties of the markets, those great gods. All this assumes, of course, something that has never been true in this country, that the society and economy will be dominated by great industries that make more or less uniform demands of their workers, as those primordial cotton mills did. We are encouraged to accept the inevitability of a dystopia, the brightest hope being that we or our children will do better than most people. An early step in making all this inevitable is the attack on higher education, a resurgence of that old impulse to force society into the form that is considered natural and necessary, an impulse that only grows stronger when society as it exists seems recalcitrant. The fact is that in general, our system of higher education could hardly be less suited to serve the unspecific but urgent purposes of the economy of the future presently imagined for us, which really bears more resemblance to that forgotten past, that dark age, which taught the benefits to the few of cheapening the labor, that is to say, depressing the living standards, of the very many. This is an object mightily assisted by high levels of unemployment and by access to labor markets where large-scale poverty is endemic. A rationale for all this is that Western prosperity sprang from the dark age of early industrialism. Post hoc, ergo propter hoc. This is a tendentious reading of a very complex history. Henry Ford's realization that workers should be paid enough to be a market for the things they made, an inversion of the old model, might be said to have come from his experiencing the limits of what Marx quite accurately called the expropriation of the worker. This so-called consumer society followed on Ford's innovation. This was novel, an object of derision at home and abroad, and it is what we are losing now as unemployment and the exploitation of cheap labor in other countries exerts a continuous downward pressure here. A consumer society is one in which people in general can engage in discretionary spending. It is characteristic of Americans that whatever they are or do is what they also ridicule and lament. But in fact, the margin above that grim old standard, subsistence, is the margin of personal freedom. And, granting fads and excesses, interesting uses have been made of it. And as one important instance, for a long time, by world and historical standards, we have educated a great many people at great cost. Our discretionary spending has also been expressed as a willingness to be taxed for the common benefit. Without question, the institutions we have created have added tremendous wealth to society over time, but we have been talked out of the kind of pragmatism that would allow us to say, "This works." No comparably wealthy society has proceeded on the utilitarian principles that would ration access to varieties of learning in the name of improving a workforce. One might reply that there has never been a country to compare with this one in terms of wealth. True enough. One conclusion we might draw from this fact is that what we do works. At the very least, it does not impede the great cause of wealth accumulation that, come to think of it, never is the stated object of competitiveness, any more than is liberty, or the pursuit of happiness, the general welfare, or indeed the examined life. By its atavistic lights, we should be prepared to navigate uncharted seas, assuming always that nothing else is offered or owed to us but work, which is itself highly conditional, allowed to us so long as no cheaper arrangement can be found. With all the urgency of this argument, holding up to us this dismal, threatening future, no mention is made of the fact that great wealth will indeed accumulate. It will not be distributed, however. The most efficient system ever devised for the distribution of wealth is a meaningful wage. The most effective means of depressing wages ever found is the mobility of capital, that same accumulated wealth, which can move overnight to a more agreeable climate. Our workers, that is, all of us, more or less, are already prepared to understand that in abandoning America, it is only obeying that brazen law. There will be a hint of rebuke, as there is now, in the fact that we failed to be competitive, which might have something to do with currency fluctuations, or with the misfortune of living in a place that is a little too fastidious in the matter of breathable air and drinkable water. This rebuke will echo through society, demonstrating to many the absolute need to jettison these standards, their immediate cost precluding any thought of their long-term benefit. Attending to public health is distributive, since it entails particular costs to achieve a general benefit associated with a general ability to prosper. I avoid the more familiar term redistributive, since it implies a real prior ownership of wealth from which a general wealth is subtracted. This notion is not supportable philosophically or economically, though at the moment it is very powerful indeed. I mentioned before that all this is somehow entangled with patriotism, with nationalism. There is a great scrum going on, now and also forever, since this model of economy has taken over so much of the world. China seems to be slowing, so India will emerge as the great competitor, presumably. We will marvel at the vast percentage increase in one measure or another of their well-being, as we always do, which any country in the world with a big enough population will demonstrate, since there are smart people everywhere, and since infusions of money and industrial technology will have these effects anywhere. Their middle class will expand, as ours would too, given capital and new infrastructure and manufacturing, though it would grow less dramatically percentage-wise, since it has been very large historically. Still, at some point, these measures of the prosperity of, say, India, would begin to be presented to us as alarming trends. They would be taken to mean that we were about to be vanquished, left in the dust of mediocrity and decline. Our cult of competition does not seem able to entertain the idea that two or more countries could flourish simultaneously, unless, of course, they are European. It does not permit the thought that our response to the economic rise of India or China or Brazil might properly be to say, "Good for them." This is the use that is made of the old habits of nationalism. We are always ready to be persuaded that we are under threat. While care for our terrain and people and future can be tarnished as socialism, to be swept up in a general alarm that impoverishes them all is somehow American. What nonsense. Let us call the stripping down of our society for the purposes of our supposed economic struggle with the world the expropriation of our workers. Academics have made absurd uses of Marx's categories so often that there are risks involved in even alluding to them. But Marx was critiquing political economy, and so am I. And nothing was more powerful in that brutal old system, now resurgent, than downward pressure on wages. Americans think Marx was criticizing America, an error of epochal consequence, propagated in the university as diligently as in any right-wing think tank. They think that political economy, that is, capitalism, was our invention, and is the genius of our civilization, the greatest ever, by grace of capitalism, so they say. Indeed, unread books may govern the world, not well, since they so often are taken to justify our worst impulses and prejudices. The Holy Bible is a case in point. Then again, there is the history of academic so-called Marxism to misinform us. It is certainly true that as colonies created as extensions of the British industrial system, notoriously involving the Atlantic slave trade, our earliest beginnings have always haunted us and harmed us too. Still, access to land, scarcity of labor and its mobility, and the communitarian ethos of the northern colonies changed the economy in fact than in theory. The iron law of wages lacked the conditions that enforced it in the old country. If Jefferson's happiness is given its frequent 18th century meaning, prosperity or thriving, then the pursuit of happiness, a level of life above subsistence, would become possible as it had not been for any but the most exceptional members of the British working class. If political economy is capitalism, then the American colonies began to vary away from capitalism long before the Revolution. In this new environment, only chattel slavery could preserve certain of its essential features, notably the immobilization of a workforce maintained at the level of subsistence and a radical polarization of wealth. Again, these were the plantations of the British industrial system, producing cotton for the cotton mills of Manchester. It is remarkable how often they are treated as if they were pre-industrial, pre-capitalist, as if cotton and indigo were comestibles, and sugar was a dietary staple, and as if the whole arrangement did not run on credit and speculation. Well, obviously, I am very critical of the universities, too. They give prestige to just the kind of thinking that undermines their own existence as humanist institutions, especially in economics, but in many fields influenced by economics. For example, psychologies that subject all actions and interactions to cost-benefit analysis, to, the phrase should make us laugh, rational choice. And this bleeds out to the humanities, of course, which are utterly, hopelessly anomalous by these lights, and have run for cover to critical theory, which is tortuous and dreary enough to look like a lot of work and impenetrable enough to evade scrutiny. In every case, the conception of what a human being is, and with it the thought of what she might be, is made tedious and small. The assumption current now that the test of a university is its success in vaulting graduates into upper tiers of wealth and status obscures the fact that this is an enormous country and that many of its best and brightest prefer a modest life in Maine or South Dakota, or in Iowa, as I find myself obliged to say from time to time. It obscures the fact that there is a vast educational culture in this country, unlike anything else in the world. It emerged from a glorious sense of the possible, and explored and enhanced the possible through the spread of learning. If it seems to be failing now, this is true because we have forgotten what it is for. Why the libraries like cathedrals? Why the meadows and the flowers? They are all a tribute and an invitation to the young, who can and should make the world new, out of the unmapped and unbounded resource of their minds. Grace and Beauty, the Comparative Literature Lecture Series at Princeton University, April 7, 2016. I have read enough about the fundamental complexity of all things, down to the very protons and neutrons, to feel at ease saying this. Beauty disciplines. I know my two-word sentence is not intelligible by conventional standards. I hope, by means of it, to move a little beyond these standards and to begin to justify my doubts about their usefulness. The fact is that I have begun to feel both intrigued and comforted by the thought of everything we do not know, which is almost everything. The 95% of the mass of the universe that is dark matter holds the galaxies together, so they say. It is like a parable, this aloof and unknowable power sustaining us, the patron, so to speak, of the spangled heavens, which are so grand to our sight, and baubles when the universe is thought of whole. Whatever it is utterly unlike the matter that is familiar to us, so I have read. How excellent it is that anything could be so unforeseen, and just as excellent and fully as remarkable that humankind has managed to catch a glimpse of it. Increasingly, I think of the mind and the universe as one great system, and the unknown and uncomprehended in their infinite variety as sutures, fontanelles, that accommodate the growth of human awareness. I'm thinking of the sutures in the skull, of course, that foresee and permit the great expansion of the brain unique to our species. This is a faulty metaphor, for a number of reasons. At some point, the fontanelles do close, while nothing we have learned implies that the unknown is by any means reducible, let alone exhaustible. Wallace Stevens says, "The squirming fact exceeds the squamous mind." Squamous means bony. Flawed as it is, I find my metaphor more serviceable, better suited to my purposes, though there is no poet I return to as often as I do to Stevens, and among his poems few more gratifying to me than Connoisseur of Chaos. Brilliant consciousness pondering the imponderable. Stevens is the great realist. How high that highest candle lights the dark. Yes, and amen. By implication, being is addressed to the mind as the mind is addressed to being. Both should be thought of as emergent, being infused with its roaring history and on its way to somewhere or something. But, given the difference between its time and ours, as if paused to tolerate our contemplation of it, and then the mind reaching after it, to call it Deus absconditus would not be wholly wrong, since it is both hidden and manifest, elusive and radically sustaining. I suppose I always find myself writing theologically, because only theology supports an ultimate coherency that can embrace equally the true, the tentative, and the flawed, as reality itself embraces them, which is only to say that we, our erring kind, are as intrinsic a part of reality as mice and moonlight. There is tremendous play in reality, or, to put the matter another way, there are far too many layers and orders of complexity in all of being to abide the simple accounts we try to make of things. This complexity is dynamic, because from moment to moment, every layer of complexity introduces any number of variables. I am aware that play and variability might not be exactly the terms I need. If they do not describe the workings of things intrinsically, but only as they are experienced, they do well enough for my purposes, since my interest here is in reauthorizing experience, felt reality, as one important testimony to the nature of reality itself. The tendency of the behavioral sciences, in their accounts of the evolutions of intelligence and language ability, and also their stark models of human motivation, are parsimonious in ways and degrees experience cannot justify. And since we all do live with our motives, even struggle with them, and since we all spend a great part of our time putting thoughts into language, mere proximity to the phenomena should give us some credibility as witnesses. We choose an utterance, a gesture. By these means we identify ourselves, and in the same moment discover and create ourselves. If it does not seem quite true to say one acts freely, the problem may lie at least in part with the common understanding of that abstract entity, one, the individual self, and with our habit of subordinating important but unacknowledged sources of manifest behavior to the behavior we think of as willed, even when it is not enacted. In other words, there are no grounds for saying that our tedious, impolitic selves, our conventional selves, however much they give us to dread or regret, are less free than any other behavior. If we understand our lesser selves as a product of social conditioning, as much can be said of our best selves. True, since Freud, the commonplace has been that our darker motives, being more primitive, are therefore more authentic, therefore freer, insofar as the word can be said to apply to this model of the human psyche. Neither statement is true or sufficient, of course. I know that my years at the work of writing fiction have conditioned my thinking about many things. The problem of finding and sustaining a credible character, a creature made of words on a page, which or who can seem to a reader to be worth attending to, perhaps caring about, brings all sorts of questions with it. Character implies consistency of a kind. A word, even a punctuation mark, can be out of character. There is an inaudible equivalent of a clang or a clunk where this kind of mistake is made. To ignore it is an option the writer really does not have. It is fair to call this an aesthetic response, and also a test of the phenomenon of credibility, that Ariadne's thread. What fiction is not experimental? What fiction does not work in delicate signals, flickers of sensation evoked by language that simulate the ways in which we know what we know? But consistency cannot mean predictability, which yields didacticism or melodrama. That old Kantian moral imperative, that a human being should be treated as an end rather than a means, can be restated as an aesthetic imperative radically limiting the degree to which character can be put to the writer's use, whether to represent a type or to make a point. These rules of mine are ignored all the time, of course, by the authors of valuable books. I do not want to imply that literature is or should be limited or judged by one set of standards. I am speaking only of my own sense that to have the feeling of human presence about him or her, a character has to seem free and constrained simultaneously, and that when this ceases to be true, credibility is lost. From this, I have concluded that a better understanding would create a synthesis of these states, though so far I can only think of them as being in opposition to each other. Practically speaking, when I am writing, I tend to think of a character as having a palette or a music, an aesthetic, in other words. While this is in some ways constraining, it establishes the limits within which substantive invention is possible, and more to the point, within which variation is meaningful. These limits liberate the character, a fact that would be accounted a paradox if it were not so familiar. There are analogies in every art which permit me the use of these metaphors. Now, if I were to give a character a childhood trauma, say, or if I were to make her materialistic or pietistic or paranoid, then she would most likely be acting out the behaviors we are conditioned to expect of people of whom such things are true. Then characterization pre-exists the character, and to the extent that it does, she is deprived of autonomy. If, on the other hand, she has a kind of coherency of tone and manner, which might be called a repertory of behavior if this could be understood as something emergent, self-renewing, self-elaborating, then these same things could be true of her without any loss of autonomy. This is beginning to sound a little like Edgar Allan Poe's philosophy of composition. I absolutely never think out characterization in terms like these before I write or as I write, but I do work from a sense of the experience of human presence, which forbids that diagnosis or moral judgment should have a central place in my attempts to conjure it. I reflect on my own exclusions, and when I do this in retrospect, it can seem as though I have proceeded on the basis of a theory rather than by following the grain of the credible as it presents itself to my mind. The standard I use is strictly experiential. What is the specific absence I feel when I miss someone? The most estimable person on earth could not fill the place left empty by a dear friend, even if it is never clear at all why that friend should matter so much. What is the abstract, the ghost, that persists in the mind, meaning him or her and no one else? What makes the atmosphere of a house change when some particular person walks in the door? Or to put the matter another way, how does our brain compose the ominous strangers who come to us in dreams with their greasy hair and sidelong looks, full of insinuation and much too believable? Why just that coat? That crudely bandaged hand? Every detail is perfectly evocative of someone we don't want to be so uncannily aware of us. I tell my students to ponder the difference between knowing about someone and knowing him. There was a time when they were inclined to provide a curriculum vitae by way of characterization, and it was necessary to remind them of the powerful distinctiveness of actual or dreamed or remembered human presence. What all this has to do with grace or beauty is not obvious at this point, I know, and to compound every difficulty, I will add another word to the discussion, an old and philosophical word, entelechy, which means the active principle of wholeness or completion in an individual thing. I have been thinking about this word for years, since I found it in the introduction to an edition of Leibniz's Theodicy, a book I seem to have begun at some point, to judge by underlinings and coffee stains, and then to have put aside, taking away no impression except of this one word and its definition. I love to look at old books for some of the same reasons botanists like to study old vegetable strains. They have not been through the often highly dubious process of refinement that have weeded out vigor and complexity, and flavor too, from the contemporary language of ideas. Entelechy means soul in some contexts, which discourages its use. and it is teleological by clear implication. So I had this word in mind for years without having any use for it. Then, because teaching and writing made me reflect on how fiction emerges, and within fiction and perhaps every other art, how good choices are made, I came back to the idea of the active principle of wholeness or completion. As a fiction develops, a writer has the exhilarating experience of losing options, of saying, of course, to things that emerge on the page with an aura of necessity about them. A great part of the pleasure of reading Dickens comes from the strange compound of utter originality and perfect inevitability invested in his best characters. After one or two brilliant details, every subsequent choice is disciplined by them. The characters, as writers so often report, have taken life and will go their own way, and their creator is obliged to respect and be grateful for their autonomy. Grace and beauty are, in the same way and in the very fact, intrusions upon authorial intent, because the fiction has found its way to its wholeness and completion. They also emerge on the page, asserting an authority the writer should be grateful to acknowledge. I am very much in the habit of going to contemporary science for analogies when I want to lift my thinking out of a course that seems conventional, which in my internal vocabulary is a synonym for deeply suspect. It seems to me, now that I grant myself the term, that there is entelechy everywhere, from the seed to the flower to the seed again. But the concept does not flourish in an environment where Darwinist assumptions prevail, with their anti-teleological answer to every question. The organisms who lack a given trait or have it in a relatively deficient form are less likely to survive and reproduce. Change is accidental variation winnowed and shaped by selection. A cuttlefish can camouflage itself instantly by becoming like the stone behind it, because the ones who couldn't do this did not survive. The most complex phenomena are ultimately that simple in the Darwinist view. New research in genetics describes the heritability of acquired traits, especially, it seems, if they are the consequence of trauma. And the fluent changes that occur within the genome, for example, make the simplicities of the Mendelian style of explanation seem very quaint. But simplicity is tenacious, and the arguments for and against are plagued by circularity. Teleology of whatever kind has been groomed out of the language in which we talk about reality, meaning that other relevant questions about the nature of time, first of all, have no place in the conversation. Before the modern period, the natural world was assumed to reflect design and intention. This way of stating things did indeed tend to close down inquiry. In order to advance, science had to proceed on other assumptions. But brute reductionism also closes down inquiry. And this can only be particularly true when language is meant to exclude the possibility of interpretation that might be encouraged by tradition and by a kind of common sense. The odds are very good that our understanding of many things is faulty, and that it is premature to attempt to weed out what might appear to be imprecisions, but are as likely to be a sort of aura of lingering possibility, intuitive play. It has been found recently that there are two immune systems in the human body, the intricate one science has long been aware of, and another simpler one consisting of cells distributed throughout the body, which in the tongue sense bitterness. These cells identify and react to bacteria and toxins immediately, while the more elaborated system takes hours or days. A shorthand explanation for the redundancy would be that the first system is a kind of holding action to compensate for the slower response of the second system. Then again, since nature is elegant, the first system might also prepare for the onset of the second one, signal it as to the nature of the threat to the organism, or tend to aspects of the threat that by their nature need to be dealt with as quickly as possible. These deployed taste buds were originally discovered in the lining of the lungs. There is teleology in this kind of language, in the suggestion that such things happen in order to protect the organism, rather than that they happen and persist in offspring, because they do, fortuitously, protect the organism. In this instance, as in a million others, it is impossible not to feel admiration for the resourcefulness and ingenuity of the body. There can be no doubt that this redundancy of immune responses, in fact, confers a great survival benefit on an organism. My own theology forbids me to interpose theological interpretation between whatever is to be known and any understanding that might be appropriate to it. To do so is, I believe, a presumption, however pious, that often tends to obscure whatever new marvels lie behind any present one. I'm impressed by great early scientists like Isaac Newton, deeply religious men who were scrupulously attentive to the given world. Still, granting that in cases like this one divine providence explains too much, it is true that natural selection also explains too much. I am absolutely not making the case for any kind of nostalgia when I say this. It is not nostalgic to express a doubt about the adequacy of a concept, even without reference to the fact that this one emerged, granting precursors, in the middle of the 19th century. I have said that I wish to reauthorize the testimony of experience, assuming that the brain and the senses are a part of nature. Who would dispute that they are? Scientists are as much inclined to dualistic thinking as the rest of us, and some of them are very inclined to alienate the mind from the world by dwelling on its long history of illusion, which might otherwise be called its long progress to our present state of knowledge, since there is no reason to assume that a higher primate should be capable of high-order intellectual clarity or interested in achieving it. It is easy to forget what an anomaly we are, allowance being made, of course, for the propensity toward error we have always demonstrated, and which becomes evident only in retrospect, allowing any present time, our own, for example, to believe it has matured beyond this propensity. The fact remains that there is no other origin for the human mind which is not dependent on theistic assumptions we have agreed, in my case for theistic reasons, not to make. I propose two things. First, that if the mind is to be thought of as a product of the world, or of the processes of which the world is itself a product in its substance and in its history, then the mind ought to be of great interest as evidence about the nature of being. It is the ultimate known instance of complexity organizing itself, not only to be efficacious in innumerable ways, but also to be free, to use a word it is difficult to use with precision. That said, it is only because we are so profoundly anomalous that we have any use for it at all. Therefore, it is a subject that is even more interesting than it is difficult. We say the mind is creative, a phrase that certainly implies a meaningful freedom. I have said a little about this kind of creation as I experience it when I write. It is free in this sense. The world would certainly never have felt the lack of an imaginary minister dying in Iowa in 1956 had anything intervened to stop me from writing a book. I would have felt no need to give an old man imagined life and death if I had not realized one afternoon that there was a highly particular voice in my head. For me, the impetus behind the book was simply that it was in my mind. I have never written a novel for any other reason. Teaching has provided me with an interesting life and a good income. Nonfiction and the reading and research it requires are very satisfying to me. But from time to time I realize I have a novel in mind, and then it is a matter of consuming interest to me to see what it is. I overstate, of course. I am at risk of another kind of dualist thinking, representing my mind as a rather autonomous being in its own right, which now and then asserts its notions and preoccupations, obliging me to collaborate in realizing them. My mind and I. Since I have set about the project of reauthorizing experience, I can only report that the dichotomy sometimes feels this absolute. In the deeper sense of the word, what does a mind know? And how does it know? Once I solved a word puzzle in a daily newspaper. It was a quote from Robert Schumann. It said that to compose music, one need only remember a song no one has heard before. This is another kind of liberating constraint, the sense of answering to what is unconsciously and intimately known, perhaps known more deeply because it is still very widely potential, the song we could not know, we yearn to hear. The impact of this sentence of Schumann's was certainly greater because it emerged out of bleary gibberish just below the comic strips and beside the crossword. I would never have expected to find a thought there that was so perfect an instance of its own truth, something I would not have thought to say, but was more than ready to affirm. Am I implying teleology here? Does art call up a response that is essentially the recognition of a new thing? This sounds like a paradox, and to call something a paradox too often ends discussion. Earlier, I introduced my favored word, entelechy, and then I left it behind. But it is precisely useful here. The active principle of wholeness or completion in an individual thing. I would say it is true of art generally that it occurs along a continuum between expectation fulfilled, however surprisingly, and expectation disrupted, however profoundly. Is it ever possible to expect Lear to enter carrying the dead Cordelia? Expectation might be called the emotional investment of the audience, meaning those who experience an art, as distinct from those who make it, and who must also participate in this same expectation in a way that makes either fulfillment or disruption a meaningful choice. Certain critics have been so struck by the social or communal aspect of participation in an art that they have reduced fiction to a species of automatic writing, and by extension, I suppose, painting to automatic painting, and so on. The writer is thought of as entrapped, incapable of saying or meaning anything other than whatever her culture induces in her, strive and struggle as she might. This makes interpretation easy, which it really ought never to be. It also accounts rather brusquely for genre and for cultural and national aesthetic traditions. To mention that memory of a song no one has heard, to invoke Stevens's phrase, "the voice that is great within us," seems like mystification, except to people like Schumann and Stevens, who might be assumed to speak with some authority. Experience demands a richer vocabulary than theory can give it, for all its neologisms. It can never be satisfied, the mind, never. That is Stevens again. The mind is always in process, moving in time through the currents of possibility, realizing formally meaningful things in and from the flux of consciousness, paragraphs and poems that have an overplus of meaning even the writer would not have recognized if certain words had not come together in a certain order. The ways in which they are satisfying, to the ear, to the senses, to cultural memory, fill them with meaning. So, beauty disciplines. It recommends a best word in a best place and makes the difference palpable between aesthetic right and wrong. And it does this freely, within the limits it finds, cultural, material, generic. Another paradox, perhaps, a discipline that is itself free, and free to make variations on such limits as it does choose to embrace. Beauty is like language in this. It can push at the borders of intelligibility and create new eloquence as it does so. I am treating beauty here as an active principle. I use elegance as a virtual synonym for it, pleased that elegance has status by association with good thought, though I try not to exploit this. I do not mean to say that one thing or another rises to the standard of beauty. Rather, I propose that beauty manifests itself in one thing or another, even asserts itself, when accident permits. In saying this, I intend to suggest a kind of force active in reality, perhaps very pervasively, that we have no instruments to measure or record except our minds and senses. Consider the ancient, perhaps universal association of beauty with power. The greater the god, the more splendid the temple, as if like were meant to conjure like. My impulse is always to reach for metaphors, and the comparisons that present themselves to me here are to stones or ice or sandbars in a river, all of which are in the nature of the case very shapely. The lovely forms they take on minimize their obstruction of the river water. At the same time, their accommodation of the currents slows their own erosion. One might say they collaborate in persisting as themselves. They are visually more satisfying because both of these things are true at once. Elegance upon elegance. When I write, I make it a rule never to do anything, choose a name or a detail of any consequence, for only one reason or two reasons, or three, ideally. This is for me an important scruple, on the principle that things are simultaneous and reciprocal in their nature, the river and the stone. When at any point this is not acknowledged, there is a fraying of the fabric of the imagined world. This sounds very intentional. It would be truer to say that on such grounds my mind warns me away from ideas I might myself have considered pretty good. Through the whole length of this essay, I have been trying to earn the occasion to say that our intuitions having to do with the way things are and become are real enough to participate in the elegance of meaningful complexity, which may be one definition of beauty, a necessary if not